We spoke earlier about the heat waves facing much of the world this summer. And in even the most optimistic scenarios, climate change will continue to worsen for years to come. So unless you're truly committed to denying reality, you may be asking, how are we going to live with this? How can we live with this? Daniel Sherrill has been wrestling with these questions for most of his life. He's a climate activist and an author, a millennial born in 1990. Sherrill's recent book is called Warmth, Coming of Age at the End of the World. He talked with our producer, Gofen Mputubwele.
I came across Daniel Sherrill's book, Warmth, last year. And the premise of the book is this. He's a climate activist, and so he's writing a book to his future potential child. Like a lot of people that I know, he's like, is it ethical to have a kid when they're going to grow up in a climate disaster? And so this book is a letter to that future kid talking about the present that we live in now. And somehow I feel like the book creates space for me to sort of think about the state of the planet, like emotionally, in a way that I normally wouldn't. Here's an excerpt from his book. It was in the early 2010s that the storms began to feel like more than just weather. They'd become semi-routinized by now. Another way to mark out the time. When a storm made landfall, footage would flash for days across every screen in the country. The more catastrophes I witnessed, the more a pattern began to reveal itself. Maybe by the time you read this, Hurricane Maria will have become a footnote. Its importance diluted by the accelerating chain of subsequent storms that, as of now, have yet to occur.
I grew up in the 90s. It was the end of history. Francis Fukuyama had declared we would all, you know, work 9 to 5 and go shopping and die, and that state of affairs would be basically stable forever. And my father, who's an oceanographer, would and did a lot of research in Antarctica when I was growing up, would come back and sort of share with me, like, there was this thing happening down in Antarctica that would eventually come for the rest of us, where the planet that we'd assumed was a sort of stable premise of our short little lifespans was in fact going through like pretty fundamental upheavals. And that was a very strange thing to learn about as a small child, you know, 8 or 9, to be like, okay, that seems like quite a big deal, but I don't see anybody around me talking about it, let alone emoting about it. Mm-hmm. And so I guess it's just not that big of a deal after all, and I'll sort of sublimate it or bury it.
Yeah, I definitely hear what you're saying. And I think when you do start to take on the emotion, in my experience, that can feel super overwhelming. And that sort of makes me think of the story of Noah with the flood and how it like increases little by little, like the rains and the waters are rising from the deeps and all of that. I think of that when I start to sort of like allow myself to emote about everything that's going on, like the sheer number of things going on in the world around me.
The metaphor, you spoke about the beginning of Noah and the waters descending from the heavens and rising up from the earth. And I went to Jewish day school, K-8, so I'm familiar with the legends of Noah. And, you know, what that really reminded me, I spent a few weeks in 2019 running creative writing workshops at the university in Tuvalu, which is a tiny, tiny nation in the Pacific, one of the lowest-lying island nations in the world. And they are experiencing right now exactly what Noah did. On the one hand, the seas are percolating up through the ground level so that the freshwater lens on which they rely for their agriculture, for their drinking water, is slowly getting more and more saline and basically undrinkable. So you used to be able to grow fields of taro on these islands, and you just can't grow that anymore. It's essentially a food desert. They have to ship in everything from Fiji. And then on the other hand, storms in the Pacific are getting worse. And so the rain is lashing down from above and they're being squeezed. The emotional technologies they developed to deal with this, the sort of humor, the grit, the sarcasm, the ennui, the like pure hedonistic pleasure seeking, mm-hmm. the mixture that they'd arrived at, I think, is something that we've yet to develop. I think there's sometimes this fantasy with the climate crisis, with racial injustice, with economic injustice, that there's going to be an end, you know, some final catharsis and the credits roll and we've either won or we lost. And that various people with various crystal balls want to, you know, they make a career out of telling you it's going to go one way or another. And I think that relieves us of the burden of having to grapple with the weight and the uncertainty every day, which I find to be one of the hardest things about this. And yet, like, walking that tightrope between those two poles of despair and optimism is, to me, like, part of my life's work as a climate organizer, is staying on that tightrope that I would call reality.
Here is an important piece of context, something I'd like you to know up front. Occasionally, amid all the storms, I'd feel grief. The grief had its own weather. It could come down like a squall, momentary and encompassing, impervious to forecast. This was a weight I kept private mostly, unsure of whether or how to share it. But alone, it rose up in me like a whale from a depth, almost invisible until the moment it breached, water streaming from its flanks, the most powerful thing in the world. And like with a whale, the breaches seemed to come at random, when I least expected them. I cried about it in line at the grocery store, and in the bathroom at parties, and by myself in the shower. Never loudly, just a few tears, messy and quickly stifled.
I wrote a deeply anti-fatalistic book, and I'm not a fatalist. But we know that it's going to get worse before it gets better. And probably, at least for the duration of my lifetime, will continue to get worse. If it gets better, it might be a few generations hence. And so how do you sustain yourself over, like, those coming decades, the roller coaster that we know we're already on?
Yeah, I mean, I think, I'm going to say this before I forget. I think that one of the things that you said that just is stuck in my brain is emotional technology. Because it does feel a little bit like the technology of our emotions as to the moment and the era that we live in, particularly for, like, our age, feels basic.
Yes.
Right?
Yes. You know? Totally. I mean, that's why I wrote this book, right? You know, I didn't set out to write a book. I set out first to read a book. You know, I love literature, and it's a way it's like a major means of processing reality for me. And I set out to look for a book that could sort of countenance the weight of the climate crisis in the present. Rather, there was a whole body of science fiction, some of it very good, that displaced the climate crisis as a sort of a futuristic dystopian premise from which the narrative could unspool. But I wanted to, like, what does it feel like to live with it now? Like, it's happening now. It made me feel lonely, you know, and it was the same loneliness I felt, you know, even as recently as 5 years ago. Like, if I had told somebody, I can't get out of bed today because, like, the enormity of the climate crisis is sitting on my chest, it just would have been, like, not really legible, you know? And I felt like the kinds of conversations I wanted to be having about this, which would have been a mechanism for sharing that weight, that were, like, vulnerable and honest and commiserative and confused and maybe even hopeful, like, there weren't the cultural avenues to have those conversations. And so I just spoke to myself. I mean, that's what a book is, in a way.
So I often describe it this way to people, is that, like, climate has never been one of my things, is, like, often the language that I use, right? And I think and the reason is that I think that the thing that's interesting and the thing that's interesting about reading your book is that, like, it almost is, because whenever it's come up, I've just been like, I don't even have a framework to deal with this in any way that's not just like, I guess it's too late. Like, I don't even have basic vocabulary. I don't have subject and verb and, like, you know? And so it just, like, reiterates that idea of, like, the ability to conceptual, metaphysical, whatever, ability to grasp a thing or to grapple with a thing, you know?
Yeah, totally. Yeah. I think that's part of what I was trying to do with his book, is I realized also that I didn't have the words, and that in some ways words themselves were inadequate vessels, but I was trying to, use them to arrive at a place beyond language that would essentially be like a new feeling in my inside myself that could accommodate what seemed like an unaccommodatable reality of the climate crisis. So you're, but, and it's sort of funny, you know, that there's the, I can imagine the response in my head, whatever, like the Tucker Carlson's of the world is, you know, when they hear millennial despair, it's like, okay, go cry about it, snowflake, which is kind of honestly hilarious. Right. But it's, it's also wild to me to cast us as the children here, as the immature ones here, when in fact we are trying desperately to figure out how to accommodate new realities and learn to survive, while they are marching blindly into oblivion. You know, I'm gonna choose to treat this huge swath of people and this huge swath of the literal, actual, physical substrate on which we live as essentially ignorable. Like, it turns out, you just can't do that without risking the whole thing, you know? Like, it's sort of like you have to actually see reality. Mm-hmm. And so part of what, you know, the climate movement, I think, is set out to do, much like the Black Lives Matter movement, is to, like, force the polity to, like, actually live in reality and see the full picture and see the full humanity of everybody and see the full tangibility of all ecosystems. And, like, it's sort of like an ontological reorientation, because I feel like capitalism has been built on this, like, narrowing of the aperture, that, which is what allows you to create immense violence and sacrifice zones beyond the boundaries of the aperture. And so we're just, like, trying to force it wide again. But it's really hard. My dear friend Emily and I, who's featured in the book, we've been talking recently about, especially in the wake of the Glasgow COP, about the Horcrux model of climate change. For all the, just to flip us back to middle school for a second. Bear with me. And, you know, there is a huge swath of outcomes between 1.5 degrees Celsius of warming and 3 degrees Celsius of warming, which is what we're currently on track for. When I was growing up in the 90s, when nobody gave a shit about the climate crisis, we were on track for 4 or 5 degrees of warming. That's basically like Mad Max, you know? It would have led to mass human die-off. And we still might be heading in that direction, but we have bent the curve of emissions down somewhat. And so there's this vast array of outcomes, and between 1.5 and 3. And for every tick of the thermometer between those two poles, you are saving or consigning millions of people to life and death. And so Emily and I are like, okay, there are 15 tenths of a degree between 1.5 and 3 degrees Celsius. and much like the Horcruxes, each one of those things is going to involve an almost impossible seeming political mission. And that the rest of our lives is going to be spent on, you know, probably all of my work for the rest of my life will maybe be some small part of shaving off one of those 15 tenths. Mm-hmm. But when I imagine myself behind a veil of ignorance, like not having been born yet, and somebody were to tell me, you know, you would be born in 1990, the year the first popular book on global warming would be released, you'll see it as you come of age, it'll transition from a niche research topic to an ongoing global catastrophe. Obviously, I would have felt grief about that, and I do feel grief about that. But also, if somebody had, you know, likewise told me that you're going to spend the rest of your life coming together with people who share your values to try to create a polity and economy that actually treats everybody with dignity, I kind of can't think of a more meaningful way to spend a human life.
Where is it that you land in your book? Like, tell me about, like, the kind of psychic, you know, spiritual, whatever ending of that you land on.
Oh, gosh.
Give the, like, short version.
Yeah. So I don't know if I arrive at, like, a pithy piece of advice by the end of the book, but one of the thoughts I had as I was concluding writing it was, it clarified for me what seemed to be the chief ethical and political responsibility of being alive in the 21st century, which was to pay active attention to the huge swaths of the natural and human world that the stories I was fed as a child taught me to ignore. And that stretching those boundaries of attention outward, political attention, economic attention, cultural attention, organizing attention, is the only way we're going to survive. And when I'm feeling hopeless, which I still am often, it's always something I'll be moving through. It's never something I'm going to have left behind, I think, because there's never going to be that conclusive credit roll where we've either won or lost the climate crisis. I think it's going to be a pall over my life for the rest of my life. But the fact that the path to collective survival runs through expanding our notion of who is a person and who is deserving of love, even beyond the human species. I'm sometimes overwhelmed by the beauty of that. Mm-hmm. And honored to be a part of that project.
Yeah.
Even if I don't, I have no assurances it won't end in tragedy.
Daniel Sherrell's recent book is called Warmth, and he spoke last year with Gofen Mputobwele, a producer for our program.